Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today's conversation, I'm glad to be joined from Zacks Investment Management by Brian Mulberry. Brian is the firm's chief market strategist and had joined Zacks Investment Management in 2017. Brian has 25 years of experience in the area of investment management. Brian, thank you very much for dropping by Talking Markets, spending some time with our listeners, our clients here at UBS, and I know we have a lot of timely topics we would like to cover with our audience on today's episode. So first off, Brian, great to have you. Thank you for dropping by.
Pleasure to be with you, Dean. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. So as mentioned, we'll touch on a variety of timely topics and, of course, spend some time on positioning guidance as well, your thoughts on equities a bit later in the conversation. Though to begin, because we've been hearing a lot about this in the headlines, private credit, specifically defaults, redemptions, top of mind for investors at the moment. How are you viewing this, Brian, as it perhaps being a broader market risk?
You know, I think it's important to kind of define the scope of private credit right now. Just in terms of the entire value of that market, it's around $1.8 to $2 trillion. And you compare that to the market cap of all U.S. equities at roughly $75 to $80 trillion. It's a pretty small portion of what's available for investors to choose from. So just defining it in that way, it's not as big a problem as some might expect. But there certainly are issues there. There is, you know, some concern around the monetization of the software as a service, where future revenues aren't growing quite as fast as they were before. And that's causing some of the valuation of the loans and the collateral inside of the private credit market to get marked down. And so that has caused concern. It makes people want to get their money out of something that they feel like is losing value. But of course, these are closed products where they gatekeep how much can actually be liquid at any one point in time. And I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding there just in how these products are structured, and it creates even more anxiety when you can't get your money out of something that you feel like is declining in value.
Well, Brian, that is some helpful clarity on the private credit front. Now, as we're speaking today here on Thursday, April 30th, we are making our way through the Q1 reporting season. I believe some 40% of the S&P 500 reporting this very week. How have results been coming in relative to your expectations, and how have these results been comparing year over year?
Well, our expectations were pretty strong. We were looking for somewhere between 12 and 14% earnings growth. And as to your point, we're almost halfway through the Q1 reporting season. Results have been much stronger than that, so even better than our, you know, really good expectations at this point in time. I think part of the relief is that software really isn't dead. That was part of the concern earlier in the year, and what we're finding is that these very large companies, we got four of the Mag 7 that reported yesterday, and Apple goes again today, and what you're finding is just that demand is so broad that we're not seeing AI kind of diminish one side versus the other. There's so much demand out there. It's driving growth in those big technology names. Those names are starting to spend even more money. That's starting to filter out into the broader economy. So we're seeing that earnings growth come from both the technology sector, as it has been the last few years, but now it's starting to move out into even more cyclically value sectors like durables, industrials, anything really that has to do with the build out of AI infrastructure. Caterpillar this morning, blowout earnings. We're seeing all of that as a result of the giant CapEx numbers that are growing AI infrastructure.
Now, an interesting consideration with geopolitical risk, perhaps in some cases reshaping the cost environment for companies. How has or how might, Brian, this reflect in forward-looking guidance or even showing up in management commentaries? I'm curious as to what you've been seeing or hearing this quarter.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that the conflict in Iran has had a direct impact on energy prices. And the concern isn't necessarily on the crude side. A couple of weeks ago, when we thought we had things kind of, you know, normalized for the Strait of Hormuz and traffic could continue to resume, you know, oil prices went down very quickly, almost as fast as they went up. And so what that's telling us is it's not really the crude that's the problem, but the lasting impacts of the Strait of Hormuz being closed is going to be on the refined product side. So things like nitrates and ammonias that are in fertilizer, There's some really big refineries in the Gulf region that are closed because they've been under attack and they've been damaged. And so it's really about the refined products that will be a little bit more expensive until that production comes online and the tanker traffic normalizes through the Strait of Hormuz. So with that pressure out there, there are concerns that are starting to show up in a number of different earnings calls where people are talking about input prices potentially a little bit higher. At the moment, it seems to be absorbed by the market in terms of it's going to be a short-term, you know, type of a situation where it could unwind very quickly as long as they can get the Strait of Hormuz back to normal, which would be somewhere around 100 to 120 vessels per day, and unwind this backlog of products that are just kind of, you know, stymied there in the region at this point in time. But there's no question that if it stays closed longer or much longer, say all the way through the summer months, then there will be material headwinds to what earnings growth and even GDP growth can look like, just because you're constrained on some of these important elements that are drivers of the economy.
So in terms of how this is translating to investor sentiment, broader equity market price action, and again, we're recording on Thursday, April 30th, we've seen a bit of choppiness this week in equity markets, though despite the ongoing geopolitical concerns, the unknowns as it pertains to the U.S.-Iran war, how do you explain, Brian, the market resilience we've seen as equities have largely recovered recent geopolitically driven losses and have turned positive on a year-to-date basis?
Well, I there's a lot of pressure. There's no doubt about that. And we even got kind of a cloudy picture coming out of the Fed with, you know, three of the voting members wanting to restate their guidance in that there would be no more rate cuts for the foreseeable future. So there are definitely some negative pressures for this market to digest in the moment. But I think the resilience is underlined by the fact that things are still really strong from a macroeconomic view. When you look at what happened in terms of durable goods orders, and in particular that non-defense ex-aircraft number being up 3.3%, that's the strongest read in almost 10 years. So again, the CapEx spending, that $660 billion coming from the hyperscalers just this year alone, is having a positive impact in broadening out growth in the economy. It's showing that there's, you know, some really good resiliency in the labor market. Wages are going up. So from a macro perspective, most of everything that we can weigh and measure about the economy is still net positive. And I think that's what leads into the recent highs, if you will, in the equity market.
That is an encouraging backdrop, though still a lot of uncertainty out there. You think as an equity investor, how do you navigate this environment? If we talk a bit about equity positioning, what are you recommending at this time, Brian?
Well, given those risks that are still out there that we just talked about, one of them, again, being interest rates, and what happens in a higher for longer interest rate cycle is you really do start to see higher quality companies do better. And that's exactly what's happening. What do I mean by high quality? I mean, these companies that are able to grow organically and invest in their future growth without having to leverage their balance sheet. So those folks that have too much leverage, too much debt piled up on their balance sheet, it really is having an impact. And you can measure that by just simply looking at 2025 and the fact that there were more than 800 large cap bankruptcies. So in this environment, it's really important to be a good steward of that revenue that comes in the top end of your balance sheet. We really want to dig into some subsets of factors that reveal more quality, things like, you know, cash flow yield, free cash flow. It really gives us an idea of what the engine, the driver of future profitability is going to look like. So we can be a little bit more picky and lean into what we think are some more defensive but higher quality types of names, given the balance of risks that are in front of us right now. We feel like that's important.
Now, earlier this year, Brian, we have to spend a few moments on artificial intelligence. And up earlier this year, we did have greater concerns about a possible bubble in the market stemming from AI. How are you thinking about this in light of current valuations? And what might the next leg of the AI trade look like?
Absolutely. I think the biggest question that we, and I think most other investors as well, were asking is, okay, if you're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on the growth of data centers and basically computing power, you know, when and how long will it take for that money to come back to your balance sheet? And when that revenue comes back, will it have, you know, profitability to it? So Microsoft in particular looking to spend a couple hundred billion dollars to grow 100 data centers. We just want to know that the demand for AI is enough to support that investment. And when they do get those data centers online, it'll be returning profitable cash flow back to their balance sheet. So what we've learned from their report yesterday is that's true, and that, you know, a number of these companies said that they would have actually made even more money if they had more available computing power. So the demand structures are there. That means the CapEx that's being spent is good money. It's a good investment at this point in time. But we're always keeping a close eye on making sure that there's going to be some type of return on that investment. And you're starting to see, you know, some winners and losers in the market's eyes. Meta is one of those companies that really doesn't have the best track record of investing capital. Just think about them changing the name of Facebook to the Metaverse, and they poured $12 billion into the project that literally returned not even a nickel in revenue to the balance sheet. So what you're finding is investors are definitely going to pay close attention on the monetization of AI. And I think that in the moment, there are companies like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google that are doing it better than others.
Well, Brian, we've covered a lot of ground on today's episode, and thank you again for sharing your insights with our listeners. Before we close out, any final thoughts, takeaways, or anything you would like to reinforce to our audience today?
Well, again, we really just appreciate the partnership and the opportunity to be here. And my final thought would be about AI, as I think what we learned this week as well is that software isn't necessarily dead. The fact that we have a shortage of computing power makes this still a competitive landscape. So these bigger cloud-based models that are not generative AI, meaning they're not autonomous, but they still have agency, meaning that they can complete tasks, that gives them scale and leverage in pricing. Whereas if you are trying to adopt a fully generative stack, you're going to have to build that out yourself. And it's incredibly expensive because of the shortage of computing power that's out there. So in the moment, software is not dead, and it's going to be a very interesting competition going forward, given how expensive it is to engage with. So I think that means there's a lot of players at the table right now. And in the future, there will certainly be winners and losers. For us, it all comes down to how you monetize it and if it's profitable. When we go back to our lessons learned from the tech bubble in the late 90s, that was really the guiding light, is the companies that were able to generate revenue but do so profitably were the ones that survived in the latest or in that last technology wave that we saw in the late 90s.
Well, Brian, you've been very generous with your time. A pleasure speaking with you today. And thank you again for dropping by Market Moves for the Talking Markets podcast series. The conversation will continue at some point, I'm sure. Thank you again, Brian.
Thank you.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.